It's not exactly news that America's education system is mediocre and expensive in international comparison. What's less well known is that our school's ineffectiveness and inefficiency could have big implications for the country's economic growth in decades to come. In a new book from the Brookings Institution Press, three of the world's leading education scholars explain that nothing short of America's prosperity is at risk due to our educational underperformance. In today's Education Next Book Club, we'll speak with all three authors, Eric Hanushek, Paul Peterson, and Ludger Wotsman, about the evidence they bring to bear in Endangering Prosperity, a Global View of the American School. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, great to have you here. We are very excited to have all three authors, including Ludger, with his only English language interview for this book.
Right, I just flew in for this one.
Yeah. Okay, very good. I'll admit that I like the book a lot, but that's going to make me want to push even harder on you with some tough questions. But let's start with an easy one, first of all. Why did you think it was necessary to write this book? I mean, this isn't, as I said before, it's not exactly news that America's schools are underperforming. Did you feel like there was some part of this message that was not getting through to the public or to policymakers?
Well, there are two things that are really important. One is that the problems are not confined to low-performing students. Even our most talented students don't look that sharp when you compare them to students around the world. 7% of our students are performing at the advanced level in math compared to 13-14% in Canada and Germany. So, and that's just one example. We're number 30 in that list. And the other one is the one that you mentioned in your opener, and I'll let Ludger speak to that, just how the skills of our society over the long run are at risk.
So it's really the right that there's this impression that, well, we just have an achievement gap problem on the one hand, or that, you know, even if our schools aren't doing great, hey, we're still the biggest economy in the world. We still are the ones who keep coming up with these breakthrough innovations. So we're doing fine. Things, you know, settle down. Don't be so, this is Chicken Little all over again.
Yeah, if you want to understand why some countries have done well or not so well over the past, say, 50 years, I guess student achievement, educational achievement of the population is the one big factor that can explain that. And so, after all, this is exactly the one thing, if you think in the long run, that you should consider when you're wondering which can benefit your economy the most.
All right, so let's talk about that. You make some very big claims in the book about economic growth and student achievement, that countries that do raise the skills of their population later see big gains in economic growth. So tell us more about that. I mean, it seems like that's a big statement, that it matters more than, I don't know, tax policy or the regulatory environment or the rule of law, all these other things that other people would say matter a whole lot to economic development. Are you sure you're not overstating the case here?
Well, let's just look at the facts. I mean, that's, after all, the one thing you should look at. And, of course, other things matter as well. If you want to understand why some of the developing countries are really poor now, property rights, lots of these institutions are very important, of course. But I mean, apart from this and apart from openness to international trade and the world economy, the one big other factor that comes in empirical analysis is educational achievement, as you measure on international student achievement tests. So if you try to understand economic growth differences over the past 50 years among some 50 countries that have ever participated in international comparative tests, it's really nearly fully explained by the growth difference are nearly fully explained by differences in educational achievement.
And Rick, we've had this conversation before about whether this is a causal link, whether it's that achievement is causing economic growth, or could it just be that as countries get richer, not surprisingly, their students do better on these sorts of tests? Had some new analysis in the book that's trying to make this case that this is indeed a causal link.
That's what's behind the analysis in this book. We've been doing a lot of work on these growth relationships, and people are skeptical, rightfully, that you can make much out of international comparisons. But if you look in a variety of ways at this, the story holds up. The U.S. actually does better than you'd expect because of its economic institutions and so forth. But if we look across other countries, we see that there's no relationship between spending of countries and their achievement, something that you would think if the causation went the other way. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other tests that you can do that rule out whether it's just culture, whether it's that countries that grow faster spend more on their schools and so mm-hmm. forth. And there might be a little bit of mistake in this, but the answers are so large that even if you cut the historical patterns we see in half, mm-hmm. you get numbers that just dwarf, for example, the costs of the current recession.
And, so, and you look at the time lag as well. You are able to show that it seems like in most of these countries, the higher achievement comes first and the growth
right.
comes
I mean,
later.
That's, I mean, some of our recent research really looked into these causality things, and a bit of that is really a bit complicated and more for the econometric aficionados. But maybe a couple of things like are pretty straightforward. So if you just look at international test scores that have been given until 1984, and then look at economic growth since 1985. So you have test scores first, and then just look at the growth performance right after that. You see exactly the same picture. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's even larger, the effect of test scores on economic growth, if you do it that way. Mm-hmm. Or a second thing is really maybe the hardest test. If really countries have changed their test performance, did growth rates change? So we could look at that for only a few countries. But if you look at it this way, you can see nearly one-to-one relationship between the fact that countries that have increased their test scores mm-hmm. over time actually also saw their growth rates increase.
Now, you know, you've written, and a lot of people understand this, that it's the student achievement, it's not credentials, that if you try to look at just the number of years people spend in school, that these relationships are what, they are not as strong, or they disappear entirely?
They disappear entirely. Yeah. What we see is that if you just looked at the simple relationship between years of schooling and growth, you would see that there was some relationship. Mm-hmm. It doesn't explain a lot of the mm-hmm. growth differences. But once you take into account what people know on international tests of math and science, you see that that entire relationship disappears. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that going to college isn't important. These tests are earlier and so forth. What it does mean is that students that go to college better prepared learn more in college.
That's right. You have to actually learn something there to get the benefit from it. So math and science, a lot of people would say, look, this is like the man who's looking for his keys under the street lamp because that's where the light is, even if his keys might be someplace else, right? That, okay, we've got these math and science tests, but what if there's other stuff that also matters, maybe matters even more? People are big on these non-cognitive skills recently, for example, things like grit and perseverance. Isn't it possible that those sorts of skills might matter just as much?
Well, it is entirely possible that there are more things that affect growth than just math and science skills. Probably math and science skills are correlated with grit and some of these other characteristics, so that if you have these other qualities, you are more assiduous in your studies and you acquire these skills. And maybe the educational system fosters the development of all of these things at once. I think it would be a great mistake to believe that you sort of foster grit at the expense of math or vice versa. Now, reading skills are something separate, and it is the case that we emphasize math, and we do it for two reasons. One, you are more certain that students are being asked the same question when you make international comparisons in different languages when posing a math or science question, especially a math question. Mm-hmm. It's less so for reading. The other factor is that reading skills have a lower correlation with growth over time. So you suspect that the scarce skill in a society is mm-hmm. math skills.
But societies that have good math scores look pretty good on reading, too. I mean, these are very highly correlated. It's skills that matter.
Now, a lot of people would say, okay, sure, some of those Asian tiger countries, the South Koreas and Singapore and Taiwan and others, sure, they look great on these tests, and their kids spend all this time cramming for their own exams, and as a result, they've got very high math and science skills. But, you know, they're not seeing the same kind of breakthrough innovations that continue to come out of Silicon Valley and that continue, you know, it's still America that comes out with the Facebooks of the world and the Googles of the world. So clearly, you know, something about our education system is promoting a more creative kind of person that is able to do these sorts of things. We don't want to become like those Asian countries where all they do is they just are, you know, just math and science drones. What do you say to those arguments?
Well, that's not entirely obvious that this is the relationship, because our economy has a lot to do with innovation. If you live in Silicon Valley, you see that people are heavily rewarded for doing innovative things. If you live in Korea, they aren't rewarded for innovation so much. So it's not clear that it's our schooling system that creates the innovation as much as the economic institutions that we have.
So from your perspective, these concerns that if we become more like, say, South Korea and have kids spending all this time cramming for math and science tests, that they'll lose something important, that they might lose that creativity, that spark, that you don't worry about that. You don't think that's something that's a major concern.
Well, we attract a lot of talent from around the world that seems very creative. And so a lot of that talent that's out there in Silicon Valley is really coming from abroad. So whether it's really a product of the wonderful American educational system that from which you have to flunk out in order to be creative, I don't think that's the right explanation for what's happening in the advanced technological sectors of our society.
So if I could just add, the countries like Korea and Taiwan and Singapore have performed at the top of these international tests. By the historical relationships, they've gained an extra 2% per year in the long run in terms of growth because of these skills compared to what they would be if they had average skills. On the other hand, if you look at Peru and South Africa that are at the other end of the extreme, they've lost 2% per year compared to what would happen if they had the average skills. So part of what we see is that these countries that have, one way or another, got higher measured skills also do better in economically.
Right, and this ends up having huge implications for standards of living, right? I mean, this is when people talk about growth, let's remind our education audience, right? This is not an abstract idea here. This means that the whole country gets wealthier. It means it's easier to deal with things like rising pension debts or right paying for baby boomers who are now going into retirement. It's easier to afford social services and things like preschool, right? I mean, this makes everything easier.
Well, absolutely. We have these fights in Washington, D.C. about the fiscal problems facing the country, and should we cut expenditures, should we raise taxes, are just consuming the Congress. But if we had slightly faster growth, say what we would get if we were up to Canada's level of achievement, according to historical patterns, we could completely solve the Medicare fiscal problem and our other fiscal problems.
Of course, some of those other countries with high growth, they still squabble over these sorts of things as well, right? That doesn't mean that the fighting over resources goes away, but perhaps it gets easier. All right, let's talk about the comparisons more specifically here. So you dig into a lot of data and look at how we rank compared to other countries, and you slice and dice the data lots of different ways. I think everybody out there knows that on average, we don't look so great. We're kind of in the middle of the pack compared to many other developed countries. But isn't this the main thing we hear is, look, this is because America is such an outlier in terms of child poverty. That when you look at childhood poverty, we have huge rates of child poverty compared to any other developed countries in the world. Isn't that the story?
Well, if you really just look at our white population, where the poverty issue is not as severe as it is with the minority group population, and you compare our white population with other countries around the world, their entire population, you know, including their minority populations, we still fall way down the list. I've forgotten the exact number, but it's in the 20s. And if you look at as I said before, if you look at the percentage of students performing at the advanced level, at the high level, we're number 30. And you presume that if you're going to move that number from 7% to 14%, you're going to be bringing it up from a part of the population that's other than the most disadvantaged segments of society. So it's across the board. It's not like our American educational system works wonderful for some kids and terrible for other kids. It's not like that. It doesn't work very well across the board.
The one comparison that really struck me is that if you look at the achievement of kids who have a college-educated parent, mm-hmm. you would think that's the best preparation for schooling, they would rank somewhere around 15th or 16th in the world compared to the total populations in 15 or 16 other countries. So this doesn't suggest that it's all just the bottom end of the distribution problem, mm-hmm. but in fact we have very broad issues with our schools.
Now, when you look at those rankings, though, I gave a look at some of these, and so if you look at, for example, white students in America, so they rank at about the same level as students in Australia, students in Germany. It doesn't sound so bad. I mean, you know, we're happy to be on par with those countries, right? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, but think about, I mean, this is the whole of Germany. If you look at the college-educated parents' kids in Germany, I mean, you would lift that up quite a bit again. I mean, in particular, lots of these European countries have huge, relatively poor migrant populations that actually, in that sense, give you the same type of problems. And so, in a sense, it's quite unfair to compare, like, the white or the advantage groups from one country to the whole of the other country. And that's what we just did. And still, the U.S. is not looking particularly well.
Well, there's another way of looking at this, Mike, and that is that instead of trying to say who's to blame or what factors are to blame, this is the population we have, and our future is going to depend upon educating the population we have, regardless of whether there are some disadvantaged children there or what kids who come to school unprepared.
That's right. But people on the other side of this debate will say, okay, but then what we need to do is we need to dramatically shrink America's childhood poverty rate. That if we were more generous, like some other countries around the world, if we just started going back to a welfare system, if we went back to income transfers so that there were not as many poor kids, those kids who are now poor would end up doing better.
Well, I agree with the first part of what you said, Mike, but I'm not so sure about the second part. The first part is that there's a lot of factors outside the school system that affects educational achievement. We know that the child is the most important person in their own education, and we know that their family is the second most important. So it is the case that a lot of the issues that we have in American education is the motivation of the student. We have to think of how the system could change that structure so that students would feel more motivated. But we also have to worry about the huge growth of single-parent families that's occurred over the last number of years, which cannot have anything but unfortunate consequences for the achievement of our students. But now the solution to that, is that to have more welfare transfer and more subsidies? Or is it the case that we have grown a single-parent family population because of the welfare system that we have created with huge subsidies for those who choose to live in families that are single-parent families?
And we may want to, for all of us may agree that we want to deal with the problem of poor children and try to do something about that. That's something different than thinking that that's going to solve our educational problem, mm-hmm. that automatically we will get higher achievement if we just add more income to these families.
I will say that if you look at some of these international comparisons, you know, the childhood poverty data all looks in a comparative way. And so if you have a country like the United States with a lot of inequality, our poor population looks bigger because you're comparing it to the median. If you do it more on an absolute terms and you know, that difference with other countries shrinks. It is true, though, that our single parent family population is huge compared to what you see in most of these other countries, including some other countries like Italy, where we look very similar in terms of achievement.
Other countries are trying to catch up in that dimension, I should mention.
unfortunately, that's right. So, but let's talk a little more about this then. When you do the modeling here and you think about the impact we could get on economic growth by raising achievement, do we get different kinds of impacts depending on how we do it? In other words, is it more important for us to help our lowest performing kids catch up to the middle? Is it more important that we help our highest potential kids really fulfill their full potential? Where do we get the biggest bang for the buck?
Yeah, we really looked at, I mean, this is a big question because, like, even from economics, you can think of either it's like the big brains, like the rocket scientists of the next generation that you need to prosper, or it's to have a decent education for all to prosper. So we looked at that actually separately, and what you see is that actually both dimensions are very important for economic growth. It's like in the end a bit hard to say which one gives you the bigger impact. It also depends on where it is easier to get the increases, which we don't know very well. But in general, I think it's important actually to think about both dimensions. We can go both ways, and both will help.
So both focusing on closing gaps, let's say, or helping the lowest performing kids, while also accelerating the performance of students
right,
towards the top.
Because if you get the new inventions, you get the new innovations, but they also, like, your whole economy has to use these new features, the new things. So, I mean, you need to have a skilled population throughout to be able to really gain from a really innovative system.
You mean both as employees, but also as consumers, you're saying?
As consumers, but I mean, I was mostly thinking about, like, as workers in the firms.
Yeah.
Whatever you're doing.
Autos aren't made by brawny people anymore. They're made by people behind computers that are running the assembly lines at automobile companies.
Right. They'll soon be driven by computers as well. we're going to be completely obsolete. This is great.
Well, in fact, the cars will be driven by computers instead of people.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly right. All right. So how do we turn this around? You present, again, a pretty depressing picture here, but also an optimistic picture that says if we could raise achievement, we could have this huge impact and that solve a lot of our toughest problems.
I mean, also one of the other optimistic things, I guess, in the analysis is that there are states and there are countries in the world that have managed to improve to quite an extent. So it's not all flat, and so you can be optimistic in the sense that it is possible to improve.
So what are they doing? What do we need to do as well?
Well, I just don't know what the Koreans actually did after World War II, but it's truly an amazing story that they came out of World War II after having been conquered by the Japanese and suffered under Chinese domination for so many years. And they had North Korea right across the border. They had their own war. So they had to decide, are we going to be a powerful nation or a nation of respectability? And if we're going to do that, we have to have a level of human capital. We don't. And so they made an enormous commitment, and it's paid off a huge dividend for the Koreans. So I think sometimes you have to really be in serious danger before you really realize. Now, the Germans, and Ludger can speak to this, also pulled up their socks around 2000. Maybe you could you could describe that story.
No, that's very, very true. I mean, when we had the first PISA test, as one of these international tests in 2000, it was released in 2001, the German population was just shocked by that we were so mediocre. We were just like below the mean of the pack, and we always thought like we are the thinkers and the poets of the world. And so this is called the PISA shock in Germany, and everybody knows it. Like, you go out on the street, talk to anybody, they will tell you what PISA is, and that really hurt us, and it did create like an atmosphere for change. So the one thing we really realize is that we cannot ignore the basic skills. We cannot ignore math and science. We have to focus on that. And then lots of things happen. I mean, politicians get under pressure if they are shown that their state is not doing particularly well. One of the most obvious things that happened is that we introduced central exit exams in the different states. So it's kind of, I like to think about this as an accountability device. So at the end of the day, you want to know whether students have learned something or not. Mm-hmm. And that's like, until 2000, less than half of the states would have some sort of this. And by now, actually, all but one have it. Recent research shows that it's indeed the case that those that introduced it have actually improved more than the states that didn't. So there are real policy devices that you can use to get up.
And you know, so testing is a big part of the German story. Of course, it's a big part of the Korean story, where there are these very high stakes tests, high stakes for the students, and you know, in order to get into the best universities and to bring honor to your family. So there's this whole culture of cramming for these tests. We've got a lot of tests in this country. We've been testing now, with high stakes.
They don't hold students accountable. I mean, there's very limited. We do have some exit exams from high school now, but they're very low-level exams, nothing that's particularly demanding, and they're not subject matter specific. They're more general math and reading tests. So what we really do need is to think about what's done in other countries around the world, setting up some real clear challenges for students as they graduate from high school and prepare themselves for college and hold the students accountable. I mean, the kind of testing system we have now is all right up to a point, but boy, do we have a long ways to go.
Sounds like maybe we could use something like a Common Core of standards and assessments. What do you think, Rick?
I don't think we want to get hung up on the specifics of accountability. There are a number of countries abroad that have gotten great gains in different ways. Poland got great gains, some other countries have. And if I look in the United States, I also see that some of the states, I would list Maryland, Delaware, Florida, and Massachusetts, have gotten great gains that would move us up in the international rankings if our other states could copy what had been done in those states. Now, if you look across those states, it's not one thing. It's a whole series of things built upon where they started from and what seems possible. And that's where you, I think, should also look at the international evidence. Countries that have improved have done a variety of different things, and it's not possible to stick to one thing. But what these international comparisons and what these national comparisons show us is what is feasible. And that's the important thing, that if states change and focus on outcomes, it is possible to improve.
You know, your book came out at just about the same time as a new book from Amanda Ripley called The Smartest Kids in the World, and it seems like a very nice companion. She, instead of doing this heavy quantitative work that you did, it's more of a case study looking at three high-performing countries and what they do. Her conclusion is that, look, the biggest factor is that the students are doing rigorous work day in and day out. They just, that school is harder. And the American teenagers she follows over to these other countries as exchange students, that's what they say. They say, look, it's just harder. The other kids in these other countries work harder.
Amanda's book is good, but you left out one of the important things. The motivation for her book was a graph that Ludger and I did showing how international tests have changed for different countries over time, and that on page 2 of the book, it's motivated by the same material we do. So it is really a companion to what we did.
But I do agree that she has focused in on the key to the story. We have to find a way to make schooling engaging for students, whether we can do it exactly the way other countries do it, or we have to find our own way. But we certainly, if there's any part of the American educational system that's broken, it's the American high school.
Well, I will let Paul Peterson have the last word on that. Again, the book is Endangering Prosperity, A Global View of the American School. Thanks for joining us on the Education Next Book Club. Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterin. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.